We are in the book of Ezra. We're looking at chapters 7 and 8. So if you can please take out your copy of the scriptures, turn with me to Ezra chapter 7. Ezra chapter 7. Ezra chapter 7, verses, this is page 821. 821, again, we are going through the book of Ezra. We're doing basically a survey of the book. It's all part of our ongoing study in exile and return. First, we were when the exilic prophets, and then post-exilic prophets. We concluded our study in the book of Malachi, and we'll be probably studying Zechariah in the fall, just so you know. But the key theme, God disciplines those he loves. You know, one reason I know someone is a believer is if there's a sense of discipline when obviously they're doing wrong, a sense of remorsefulness, a sense of whatever. You know, God doesn't really have to discipline those that aren't his, right? It's logic. Do you discipline your children or other people's children? All right? I mean, you're in charge of children if you're running a daycare center or you're a teacher in a classroom. But generally speaking, you discipline your children. You don't discipline other people's children. God disciplines his children. What does he do that, to those people that are not his children? He judges them. When you look at the text, you see this distinction. Okay? There's a judgment on those that are not his. There's a discipline on those that are his. What's the point of discipline? It's correction. God corrects those who are his. If you do not experience God's correction in your life, you have to ask yourself, am I truly a believer? Am I truly one of his? A lot of people walking around who say, oh yeah, I believe in Jesus. But by all statistics, it's a very small percentage even of Americans who truly are believers in the Messiah of Israel, Messiah Yeshua. Very small, maybe 4 or 5%. That's it. This relationship thing we've talked about, election, transgression, commitment, renewal. We didn't choose to become Jews. God elected us. He chose us. We didn't choose to become believers. God elected us. He chose us. God gave us instruction. He expects us to keep it. He chose us. He gave us instruction. And then if we don't do what he says, he disciplines us. But in the discipline, he renews his commitment to us. All right? We've talked about this a few times. This is the same pattern for us as a Jew, as Jewish people, as well as for us as followers of the Messiah. I had a fun, actually, I shared this down at Park Community Church with their pastors. I was asked to go and teach them a little bit. And I used this, and it blew their minds. They never thought about it in terms of the Jewish people. You know, most Christians say, well, God gave the instructions to the Jews. They didn't listen. Therefore, he was done with them. And I said, no, this is the pattern. This is the pattern. They said, oh, wow, we never saw this before. All right, the province of Yehud, everything we're really talking about is about what God is doing with the Jewish people here in this piece of real estate, a very small little piece of real estate, a little bit of Judah, a chunk of Benjamin. That's what is left in terms of the Jewish community. In the book of Ezra, we've talked about this before, written around 400 to 450, and that really the whole point of this is post-exilic literature points to the full restoration of Israel as God's covenant-obeying Jewish people, his chosen people, and the coming of Israel's Messiah, the son of David. If you didn't come on Wednesday night for the studies, you missed that because it was really clear in Haggai and Malachi. All right, and then we talked about the first Aliyah under Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel in around 536. We're now going to talk about this one with Ezra, and that's chapter 7. All right, I need this second video. Every once in a while, I get to choose something I really want to watch. This is something someone else I know really wants to watch.
You have only one choice. The ring must be destroyed.
I'll go down so I won't block your view.
What are we waiting for?
The ring cannot be destroyed, Gimli, son of Gloin, by any craft that we here possess. The ring was made in the fires of Mount Doom. Only there can it be unmade. It must be taken deep into Mordor and cast back into the fiery chasm from whence it came.
Far,
One of you must do this.
One does not simply walk into Mordor. Its black gates are guarded by more than just orcs. There is evil there that does not sleep. The great eye is ever watchful. It is a barren wasteland, riddled with fire and ash and dust. The very air you breathe is a poisonous fume. Not with 10,000 men could you do this. It is folly.
Have you heard nothing Lord Elrond has said? The ring must be destroyed.
And I suppose you think you're the one to do it.
And if we fail, what then? What happens when Sauron takes back what is his?
I will be dead before I see the ring in the hands of an elf.
Where now?
So much of it. No one trusts an elf.
I will take the ring to Mordor. Though I do not know the way.
I will help you bear this burden, Frodo Baggins, as long as it is yours to bear.
By my life or death, I can protect you. I will.
You have my sword. And you have my bow.
And my axe.
Carry the face of his own little one.
Anywhere without me.
No, indeed, it is hardly possible to separate you even when he is summoned to a secret council, and you are not.
Wait! We're coming too! We'll have to send us all tied up in a sack to stop it.
Anyway, you need people of intelligence on this sort of mission, quest, thing.
Well, that rules you out.
Nine companions.
So be it. You shall be the Fellowship of the Ring.
Right. Where are we going?
All right. Like that last line. Where are we going? What we're going to be talking about today is accomplishment. How many of you want to be failures in life? Nobody wants to be really a failure in life, do they? Some people, by the way they live their lives, they become failures. It's inevitable. All right, we'll talk about it. God always accomplishes much with just the few. God always accomplishes much with just the few. Go back, think about the text. Remember Gideon and his guys? Just a small little percentage of people. David and his people, small. Guys, God always accomplishes much with just the few. We're going to look at this today from the book of Ezra. And the reason why we're looking about it is because we're talking about Ezra's return. When Zerubbabel went back, there was maybe 42,000, give or take. When Ezra goes back, it was about maybe 5,000. It was the second wave. It was encouraging, but it was just a few in comparison. Let's take a look at the text. Let's begin chapter 7. So page 829, Ezra chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. And I'm going to be surveying this, so I encourage you to open your texts. Page 821, Ezra chapter 7. We're going to be reading, first of all, verses 1 through 10. Now, after these things, during the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, the son of Sariah, son of Azariah, son of Hilkiah, son of Shalom, son of Zadok, son of Ahitub, son of Amariah, son of Azariah, son of Meriot, son of Zariah, son of Uzi, son of Buki, son of Abishua, son of Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the Kohen Gadol. This Ezra came up from Babylon. He was a scribe skilled in the Torah of Moses that Adonai, the God of Israel, had given. The king granted him everything he requested because the hand of Adonai, his God, was upon him. Some of Bnei Yisrael and some of the Kohanim, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the sanctuary servants also came up to Jerusalem in the seventh year of King Artaxerxes. He arrived in Jerusalem in the fifth month of the seventh year of the king. He began his aliyah from Babylon on the first day of the first month and entered Jerusalem on the first day of the fifth month because the good hand of his God was upon him. For Ezra had set his heart to seek the Torah of Adonai, to observe and to teach its statutes and ordinances in Israel. So he starts off there where it says Nippur. It's not Nippur Sink, that's Nippur. Ends up in Jerusalem. Takes him a little while, several months, but he gets there. Now, we're going to talk about the requirements of the few who can accomplish much for God. I've been working with people a long time. Sometimes I think it's about time to retire. People generally want to do something. I very rarely meet young people that have no desire to do anything in their lives. Most people want to accomplish something. The problem is that often we forget about the requirements in order to do something. There are requirements. Think about the biblical text. Does not God have requirements and expectations? Yes or no? Yeah. He always does. What I've tried to put together in this sermon this morning is some of what I think are requirements. Basically, we can read them right out of this text. Verses 1 through 5 tells us that Ezra is a Cohen. Having the right background is helpful for what it is that God desires to do in and through you in regards to something. Now here, I think it's fascinating in the text. It just gives us his whole line. Goes right back through Zadok, by the way, to Aaron. I remember when I studied at Spertus, one of my professors, an Israeli, who's passed away. I wish I could remember her name. I can see her face right now. She's an atheist teaching Bible and theology at Spertus College of Judaica. And she was arguing that Zadok was a Jebusite. All right? And, of course, I'm, you know, taking the text and looking at it and said it's not a probability. That just doesn't make any sense based on X, Y, and Z. But it's interesting that later on the Zadokites become the faithful people. Why are they the faithful people? You have to go back into the text. And they were the faithful ones to God, to his instructions, to their office. I want to point out that having the right background is a requirement. What is the right background? Your background. Are you comfortable in your own skin, or are you trying to be somebody you're not? That's really important. Our biggest problem in our Messianic Jewish movement is people try to be who they are not. I am not the son of a rabbi. I am not the son of a Torah scholar. My mother is mentally ill, and my father has Asperger's. I grew up in a dysfunctional home. It's by the grace of God only that I stand before you. Nobody's been religious in my family for at least two generations. How did I come to faith? Some people prayed for me, and I became a believer. I am nothing. But there was something unique in my background that God saw, and so in his way, he called me to do something for him. Do you ever think of yourself better than you should be or different than you are? Stop it. God made you who you are. Be yourself. This whole thing that occurred in West Rogers Park, two Gentiles who want to act Jewish, completely made a big balagan. Be who you are. Don't be who you're not. Be who you are. Don't be who you're not. God will use people who have the right background, meaning he will use people who recognize who they are and want to live their lives for him as who they are, being who they are. The second, have the right training. Take a look at verse 6a. This Ezra came up from Babylon. He was a scribe skilled in the Torah of Moses that Adonai, the God of Israel, had given. He studied. Judith and I had a meeting. We were talking about the fact that it seems that education is not all that sought after here, especially even among the kids. We're going to change that. We're going to change that. We want to learn? Do we want to learn? Do we really want to understand and learn God's instruction? The Tikkun LaShavuot's coming up. Are you going to come? Are you going to come to learn? At home, do you read your scriptures on your own? Do you read other books to gain understanding? Ezra was developing the right requirements to be used of God because he was learning. He didn't go to Hebrew school. This stuff didn't exist back then. Something unique was going on in him, and he was learning. And because of that, God was able to do great things to him. Take a look at 6b. The king granted him everything he requested because the hand of Adonai, his God, was upon him. Now, the next few verses talk about the fact that he basically gained support. He gained it from the king, gained it from other people. Nehemiah chapter 1 is an awesome chapter to gain insight as to what's going on with the Jewish people in the land. Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king. Ezra, this is occurring maybe 15 years or 10 years before Nehemiah. He's also somehow or another connected. None of this has been verified historically. But the Jewish people, God was blessing even in Galut, even in diaspora, and they had gotten involved in the government. Remember Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Right? This was 100 years earlier that they were on the scene or more. God had put Jewish people into places in the Babylonian and the Persian Empire where they would be in proximity to the leadership. And they were probably working hard and doing good, because that's what we see with Daniel and his fellows. That's what we see with Nehemiah. We're assuming Ezra also played some unique role, and he had the opportunity to be with the king. The king is going to support this effort. It's a huge thing that occurs. We see it in the next chapter. Actually, at the end of this chapter and next chapter. The king really gets behind this effort. But I think somewhere along the line, Ezra had to go seek out that support. He had to be the person the king wanted to support. That's important. I was talking to somebody about this. You know, when it comes to religious work, people support people. People support people. You can send $25 a month to help the children or whatever, but generally speaking, people support people. You remember Shmuley or Tamar? How many of you support Shmuley? We do. How many support Tamar? We do. Why? Because we like them. We believe in them. That's why our congregation supports them. They were here with us when they were here. We got in relationship with them, and we support them. People support people they know and they like. Ezra recognized, I take advantage because it's all negative, but Ezra was able to benefit from the fact that he had these relational connections. And because of that, God could work through it all. But this is key. Take a look at the last verse, verse 10. For Ezra had set his heart to seek the Torah of Adonai, to observe and to teach its statutes and ordinances in Israel. Having the right motivation is key. It shows up in this text. It shows up kind of toward the end, or it's kind of stuck in the middle someplace. But Ezra had a desire, as it says, to teach its statutes and ordinances in Israel. We don't know why, but remember, in our studies in the post-exilic literature, that the people were constantly stumbling and falling. It's possible that they didn't have the teachers they needed in Israel. God raised up Ezra. Ezra was willing to follow God. He was willing to do what God wanted him to do, and so he was therefore useful for God. And then God called him through a series of circumstances and sent him off to accomplish great things for him in the land of Israel. God only needs a few people who are truly willing to do his will to accomplish great things. How it's always worked. It's never the masses. It's always the few. Think of the 12 disciples, the Talmudim. 120, that was all that were there on Shavuot back in Acts 2. Just the few changed the world. Paul and a couple of buddies travel all over the place, changed the world. They didn't lead millions and millions, but they led dozens and dozens. And through the dozens and dozens, ultimately the whole Roman Empire changed. God always uses the few to accomplish much. Now, attitude, though, is important. Attitude of the few who can accomplish much for God. Take a look. We're going to just poke through a couple of these verses. Ezra chapter 7, verse 11. Ezra chapter 7, verse 11. So follow with me, 8:22. It says, now this is a copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave to Ezra the Cohen, the scribe and teacher of matters pertaining to the mitzvot of Adonai and his statutes over Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the Cohen, a scribe of the law of the God of heaven. I have now issued a decree that anyone in my kingdom from the people of Israel, even the Kohanim and the Levites who wish to go up to Jerusalem with you may go. All right, so here we start off where we actually see this long letter that Artaxerxes wrote. Again, there's not been any historical corroboration of this, but here we have a letter that basically is to Ezra for him to take. We see something like this gets given to Nehemiah as well later on, okay? We see a letter was given by Cyrus to Shealtiel, all right? So there is some formal relationship. And I would say, this is the way I understand it, which is what I have up there, an attitude of humility that seeks help from one's leadership, from one's leadership. We're not going to look at Nehemiah, but that's what Nehemiah did. He sought the help of his leader. You know, it's too often in religion, people do not seek the help of their leaders. They just blow off their leaders and go do their own thing. You know, that's often what happens. You know, I mean, Ray was an elder at B'nai Maccabim. I'm sure he saw it on more than one occasion over there. All right? That's never the way things happen effectively. All right? God does not work with people who are not under authority. It doesn't work. Does not work. Okay? Usually what they do is they crash and burn and take a bunch of people with them. God always works with people who are under authority. God believes in authority. He establishes authority. Ezra sought the help of his leadership. And God blessed him for it. Take a look at verse 27 to 28a. Blessed be Adonai, the God of our fathers, who has put it into the heart of the king to beautify the house of Adonai in Jerusalem in this way, and it was extended loving kindness to me before the king and his counselors and all the king's mighty princes. Here Ezra is recognizing that God is the one who has put it in the heart of the king. And we didn't read all the detail because there's a lot of detail, but he gave him all this stuff to beautify the temple that Zerubbabel and Joshua, the high priest, had built in Jerusalem. Isn't that amazing? So this pagan king, not a believer, is giving them material to beautify, all because I think somewhere along the line, Ezra demonstrated the humility to ask for help. Take a look at chapter 8, verse 1. Chapter 8, verse 1. We're going to start with, again, the last part of verse 28 of chapter 7. I gained strength as the hand of Adonai, my God, was upon me, and I gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me. Now, these are the patriarchal leaders and the genealogical records of those who came up with me from Babylon during the reign of King Artaxerxes. And we could continue to read, but we're going to stop there. Here, which we see up there, is that the other point of attitude that we notice is Ezra is humbly seeking help from his community. All right? He's seeking help from his community. He's going out to the leadership of the people. Now, back then, everything is tribal. All right? There is a tribal situation. You have the patriarch of the clan. Actually, it's funny, if David were here, he could talk about this in Iraq. It exists today. How do you control a particular portion of geography in a Muslim area in the Middle East today? You talk to the tribal leaders, because the tribal leaders control the tribe. You step on the tribal leader, what happens? You die. It's a little brutal, but that's the old way things were done. Here he goes out to the tribal leaders, and he says, and these are all Jews, and he says, listen, let's go back. And we see, starting in verse 2, this long list of people who are willing to go. Not a ton. All right, about, I don't know, 1,500 if you add it all up, plus women, these are men, plus women, children, about 5,000 people and their stuff. You know, only about an eighth of the number that went the first time. But he went around and he asked these tribal leaders to come and to help, to do something with him. And I think it's really important. Want to do something great for God? Make sure you ask the people around you in your own community to do that. You have to humbly seek the help of the people that are around you. Of course, the other thing is that hopefully those people desire to serve as well, all right, in the community around you. And then take a look at 8:20, verse 8:21, chapter 8, verse 21. Then I proclaimed a fast there at the Ahava River so that we might humble ourselves before our God and seek from him a straight way for us, our little ones, and all of our possessions. For I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers and cavalry to protect us from the enemy along the way, because we had spoken to the king, saying, the gracious hand of our God is upon everyone who seeks him, but his great anger is against everyone who forsakes him. So we fasted and sought our God about this, and he responded to our plea. Interesting text, because the text reports that Ezra actually was ashamed to ask for troops. And where they're traveling, if you go back here and you look at this, that's a different route than the first group, because you're bordering on more desert area and potentially lawlessness. All right? They took that route because it was shorter. The other route's a lot longer. Nehemiah followed this route later, and what did he bring with him? A whole personal set of bodyguard. Nehemiah, the king of Persia, sent a whole lot of troops with him, okay? Because he's a governing official, and the king made sure. It's important that we seek God's help in our lives. I mean, fundamentally, it demands, though, an attitude of humility. Very easy to think about all the things we can do on our own. You get up in the morning, you brush your teeth, hopefully you take a bath, put on clean clothes. You engage in your day. But as you're starting your day, are you praying to God? God, I pray your blessing today. I pray that you would open opportunities today. I pray you would protect me today. You know, give me wisdom today. That's a humility before God. It's a great habit to have before God. Begin each day thoughtfully, prayerfully, crying out to the Lord, asking for him to help you on your way. God wants to hear your prayers. He wants to hear you request from him, because it's a demonstration of faith. All right. What they're doing here is that, in essence, because they're starting off. And I think it gives us an opportunity both to recognize Ezra's humility and maybe a little bit of his lack of faith. I don't know. I mean, the fact that this little caveat, I was ashamed to ask. It's awesome. It shows the humanity of the author. You know, it's a great piece of information here in the text. I would also point out, this is one of the reasons we have our monthly time of fasting and prayer on the calendar, which, to point it out here, if I can find it. Oh, right here, sorry. This next month, is it on here? Synagogue Day of Fasting and Prayer is June 17th. Generally, I mean, just to say it, generally, I'm surprised most people, when I ask them about it or whatever, they lose sight of it all. Fast. Give up a meal, fast, pray on behalf of the community, come for prayer, communal prayer. It's critically important. All pastors and rabbis I know, they know one thing. Prayer is hard. Most people are loath to do it. Communal prayer, where we sit together and pray, people are loath to do it. Why? It's hard. It's hard. It demands active participation of the soul. It also means you've got to be clean before God. We need to come and pray together as a community more committedly. This is a great reminder for us to pray committedly together. Pray on your own every day. Pray all the time. We should be praying all the time. But coming together and praying communally is critically important for a community of faith. The other thing we see here in verse 24 is that verses 24 through 34 that Ezra found people who he could trust. He humbly sought out the help from people he could trust. It says in verse 24, then I set apart 12 of the leading Kohanim, and I weighed out for them the silver, the gold, and the utensils, the contribution of the house of our God, that the king, his counselors, his officials, and all Israel who were present had offered. And then he says later on, they received the gold, verse 30, and the silver, and brought them to Jerusalem, and later on it says that they turned it all in. Yeah, remember that gold bowl you gave me on the way out? I dropped it. Sorry about that. I lost it. Reliability. Finding reliable people. Sometimes, honestly, I have trouble relying on people. It's true. All right? Part of that comes after years of experience. That not all are trustworthy. Not all are timely. Not all are able or willing to actually get it done the way they say they're going to do it. Anybody ever have that issue? But the reality is, in order for God to get things done, you've got to have people that will work together to get things done, to identify trustworthy people, people who are reliable. Later on, Nehemiah thought he had some reliable people. He went back to see the king of Persia, came back, and everything fell apart. Hard to find reliable people. Are you a reliable person? Are you reliable? Can people depend on you for their relationship with God? Can they rely on you to do the work of building up God's kingdom? We all are human. We struggle in different ways. We're not perfect. But as a general rule, do you see reliability within God's kingdom as an important attribute, an attitude that you have, so that you can be really useful for God and for what he's trying to accomplish? And then take a look at the last part of the chapter, verses 35 and 36. It says, "Then the exiles returning from captivity sacrificed burnt offerings to the God of Israel. They burned all this stuff up. Then they delivered the decrees of the king to the king to the king's Persian governors and to the governors of Transjordan, who then gave help to the people and the house of God." So you continue to see the fact that Ezra, his attitude consistently is the same. He's humbly seeking help all along the way. He must have been a very, very gentle soul. Next chapter, we're going to end next week. The people are sinning and doing bad stuff. And he gets all upset and he tears out his hair and he sits in dust and ashes. Takes it out on himself. Probably blames himself for what's going on in the lives of people. It's a bad thing. People in ministry should not do that. Usually people make their own stupid mistakes. Nehemiah, what does he do? He pulls out their hair and he beats them. I think it's great. Shows the contrast of leadership styles. Of course, Nehemiah was a political figure and not a religious figure. All right. Attitude is extremely important. A bad attitude poisons everything. A proper attitude leads to great accomplishment. You want to really do something great for God. You want to make sure you have the right requirements in order. You want to make sure you have your attitude in order. Because ultimately, God only needs a few people to accomplish much for him, all right? God determines the ultimate outcome of what is great to him. Haggai chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. Make sure that if you say, "I want to do something great for God," you have your attitude and mindset correct. God will not use you if it's all about you. Can't be about you at all. God will do great things through people who are all about God, not about themselves. God always accomplishes great things through just the few. And the question, can he use you? Doesn't matter what your background is. He will use you. He will use you. All the stuff in your life, as long as you're humble before him, as long as you're willing to seek him with all your heart, mind, and soul, as long as you're willing to learn of him, as long as you're willing to seek help and humility from other people, God will use you. Going back to these questions, how much time do you intentionally make daily to grow your understanding of who God is and of his instructions? That's really important. You gotta read the biblical text. You need to read the scripture to know it. You know, next year, I really would like to find a way to encourage more people to engage in the text. We're going into the summer month from which all programming must die, according to American tradition. It's unfortunate, but it's true. All right, but in the fall, I want to know, what can we do to encourage more engagement with the biblical text in our homes and in our community and among our children, not just our adults? How, with your unique background, are you becoming someone whom God can do much with? You are you. If you're older, you're the product of all your life. You recognize God can do amazing things through you and your unique background. You really appreciate that. Are you trying as hard as you can to be someone other than who you are? That's a personal question. Last, do you ask for help? Do you ask for help? Again, I struggle with it, jaded by 35 years of ministry, I suppose. But that's wrong. It's a wrong attitude. I fight it all the time, okay? And sometimes I really lose bad. We need to ask for help. Do you ask for help? Are you someone that people can receive help from? Are you willing to help people? That's important, too. Because God has us together, you know? Think about who we are. We're few. There's not many of us here. How many Jews really want to live out their lives as Jews who believe in Yeshua? It's tough. We're odd compared to everybody. It's easier to be a Jew in a church. Always easier to be a Jew in a church. Give up your Jewish identity. That's where most of our people are. Just be in a synagogue. Don't tell anybody about Yeshua. That's where there are Jews in the synagogues who are believers. And that's unfortunate because they can't have a public testimony generally. The reality is that we come together to do something, I think, great for God. We, the few, seeking to do something we cannot do alone. We can't do it by ourselves. We need one another. We, the few, seeking to accomplish something great for God based on the unique vision that He has given us in this place. We need to help one another, and we need to allow our help for what it is that we desire to do. Things to chew on, things to think about. What's really nice is that we know what happens in the end. We know that Frodo gets rid of the ring, right? Yeah, it's true. We also know in the end we win. Messiah Yeshua will return. We know that our people will turn to Messiah. We know that the nations will accept Yeshua as the Messiah, and they will stop bothering us as Jews. We know that Christians, all those who profess faith in the Messiah, will no longer be persecuted, because in the end we win. We win. We enter the rest that the Lord our God has provided for us in that eternal kingdom. Because He is God. And ultimately, we win. Let's close in a word of prayer. God, we thank You so much for the truth of Your Scriptures, the challenge of it. We thank You, God, that You have called us. You have saved us. Help us, God, to be useful for You and for the building up of Your kingdom. Help us, God, to be willing to stand up for those unique opportunities You call us individually to engage in. But help us, God, to be humble before You and to be humble for one another, before one another. Help us to be training ourselves in You so that we might be useful when that call comes. Help us, God. Help us, God, to know You and to want to serve You with all our heart, mind, body, and soul. We pray all this in Yeshua's name.